Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey guys, welcome to this very special episode because today I've got the great pleasure to be sitting across the table from Andrea Baldi, who is the CEO of Lamborghini of North America. And as you know, we recently had a chance to actually drive the new Huracan Technica. That's our man Paul who drove it. And if you like to see that review, just head on over to alltfl.com. Well, Andrea, thank you very much for coming out to Colorado, and thank you for having this chat with me.
That's a pleasure. We were here to inaugurating the new showroom of Lamborghini in Denver, so it's a great opportunity to also meet you.
So I'd like to talk about, you know, where Lamborghini is going, because of course electrification is changing the way that cars are built and changing the way that we interact with cars. But before we get to that question, let me ask you, I did some research. You're from Bologna, is that how you say it?
Yeah, this is where I grew up. Yeah.
Which is where Ducati's at and where Lamborghini's at. So did you grow up as a car guy? Were you into cars?
To be honest, not necessarily. I grew up, but then when I applied for as a student for in engineering, I was more into the industrial complexity and engineering. So I was more into anything that has to be produced. But I was pretty lucky because I grown up in an area that is called the Motor Valley, where so many companies, pretty famous in automotive, have their location. And so when it was time for me to choose what was the place where I would apply for an internship, Ducati in that case was one of the possibility. And so I got in, and like everybody, when you get in touch with this kind of companies, you get a kind of a virus, you get injected with it, and the passion is of this company is super strong, becomes yours. I became a rider first, and then when I had the opportunity to add two wheels with a company that was even more passionate than in another level when it comes also to luxury. Ducati is more premium, and Lamborghini is luxury. I had no hesitation, and so it's a very interesting community in Bologna of many of engineers like me that have gone through the different companies that are in that area. I don't have to mention the other one, but you probably know the
starts
name.
With an F.
Maserati, but also there are several others. No, so yes. It's not just Ferrari, and so it's pretty interesting because we become a sort of community. We know each other in the different companies. We move from a company to another sometimes, but essentially we are all injected with that virus that is has give birth to so many companies that are so successful, small companies
in America,
huge brands.
We would say it's like in the water, right? In the water, right?
Correct.
It's
the idea. Correct.
So, what was your first car?
My first car was a Volkswagen Polo.
Okay, all right. Which is a city car.
Which is a city car, yeah. And somehow it's also maybe destiny that I ended up into the Volkswagen group.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, and then I was reading about you, and you said you got your first job with Ducati, the motorcycle manufacturer, and then eventually you moved to China with Ducati. What was it like working for this, like you said, very sporty motorcycle brand in China?
When we opened the office in China, the zero was the number of bikes we were delivering in that market.
Wow.
We were not even homologating cars, bikes for that market. And so also we had several small markets in the ASEAN region where we knew there was a strong two-wheelers passion and market, but we were selling very few. Also Australia was a little bit neglected at that time. Japan was a big market, the only one probably where Ducati was present. So As a part of a strategy to develop that part of the world, I went there. I had the opportunity to start up the office together with my former boss, Mirko Bordiga. And it was a great Sherpa to me in anything that is Asia culture and understanding of a very different culture and market. But then we really managed to, and a couple of years I was there in Asia, to change also the culture of Ducati that was and is a product of Italy, but we convinced them to open a factory in Thailand and leverage the opportunity of the huge tax reduction if you have assembly line in that case in any of the ASEAN countries. We decided for Thailand at that time, and so this really gave the opportunity to Ducati to grow a lot in the market, and I'm very happy to have been part of this process. Then I met with Lamborghini in when I was in China, and I, like I said, after 10 years in Ducati, I couldn't resist the opportunity of going into the car industry. That is always a little bit ahead compared to the motorcycle industry, at least 5-10 years in many respects. And so it was really a big temptation. Also, Lamborghini was looking into developing Southeast Asia, Oceania, India, many markets where they were present but not really strong. And I was lucky enough to get into this adventure that became really important. Today, Asia Pacific is 1/3 of the sales for Automobile Lamborghini.
I think it must have been challenging because, like in Europe and in America, sports cars and supercars have always been kind of the top aspirational vehicle. But every time I'm in China, it's always small motor, big back seat, right? It's limousines that I think people at least seem to aspire to more than, you know, the sports cars. Did you find that when you were there? Or did you have to introduce people to what a Lamborghini was, or did they know the brand?
Well, when I joined Lamborghini in 2010, China was a market where super sport car were seen as a whole. All the brands were a little bit confused. They were exotic, and so Ferrari, McLaren, Lamborghini were seen sort of the same kind of product.
Yeah.
And I remember typically you will get a customer getting into the showroom and saying, do you have it in yellow? And if you don't, they will just go into the next showroom and do you have it in yellow right now?
So they cared more about the color than about the brand.
They cared about a certain segment. They understood that they wanted to get into super sport car, but they didn't really know what to do with the car because it's particularly difficult to drive that car. Back in 2010, there were not so many racetracks also, and the traffic were extremely intense. So it was more intended at that time as a fantastic accessory, a complement to the nice clothes or the nice house or the nice. So that was really in 12 years ago. But China has a characteristic that nobody has to underestimate it. They evolved very quickly. So they got matured as customer profile extremely fast. So even if they didn't have the, let me say, cultural background in automotive that most of our consumers will have, you know? So decades of fantasies since they are children about what is the car of their dreams.
They didn't have a Countach on their wall when
correct.
They were growing up. Yeah,
exactly. But they have been evolving extremely quickly, and they have understood very fast what is best among the best, and they started to become extremely sophisticated. And so already by 12 years after, I could say that Chinese consumers are extremely savvy, extremely prepared, and they are buying cars with a completely different purpose that they had 12 years ago. And so they also want to drive, they want to have emotions, and they want a car that is also not just an accessories anymore, but also a car to drive.
So maybe what you're saying, or at least what I'm hearing you say, is they're starting to appreciate more the engineering and more the technical aspects of the vehicle and the different flavors of Italian supercars versus just the fact that it's like a beautiful purse, right, that they can have when they go out.
I think they are distinguishing clearly what every product stands for, not just the brand. And that was already a challenge in the beginning to distinguish the brand, and then they distinguished the brand, and then they started to really understand the different products, positioning and purposes. Obviously, it's a market that is extremely SUV-oriented.
Yeah.
They really appreciate the versatility of Urus, and that remains the biggest seller in an higher proportion than what it is for a supersport car, which is still a relatively small segment for such a big country in terms of population. But definitely they are more competent than ever, and they have caught up very quickly with the cultural gap that they had in automotive. And with Europe and the United States, traditionally are mature markets.
So last time I was there, I went to dinner with like a guide, and he points to a G-Wagon, and he said, that G-Wagon's $1 million. And I'm like, wow, that's a lot, because in America, a G-Wagon would cost, depending on the model, you know, like, let's say between $150,000 and $250,000. And he said, in China, not only is there extremely tax on it, but he goes, look at the license plate. And I looked at the license plate, and it had like I think it was either sevens or sixes on it, I forget now. And he said, that license plate alone is like $500,000. And so I felt like people were using their cars as a way to show off the status in society.
There is a component of celebrating success, like in America, like in Anglo-Saxon culture. You are entitled to celebrate your success, and people will clap it. And especially in China, there is this idea of a circle, a wheel. You are part of. So today you are at the bottom of the wheel, and you need to not be envy of those on the top, because the wheel will spin. And those at the top knows that they will be at the bottom one day. And so they are respectful of those that aren't, and vice versa. You don't have to envy those that are at the top, because you will be there. And so you also are entitled to have that dream. And this is sometimes difficult to understand in the East. I think most of Chinese have a very clear perception of their dreams can become true in life, similar to what is in America. Very similar, way more similar than what we seems to presume if I read the press in the East. So. I think everybody in China are socially accepting to see this car, the display of wealth, and as far as this is not too, let me say, exaggerated. And sometimes this has created also some issue to some very wealthy Chinese, you have read in the press, especially somebody has become a little bit spoiled. And so, again, there is a way to display wealth, and if you are a successful entrepreneur, it's absolutely acceptable that you do so. But still, you need to distinguish what has become a mature approach to buy a supersport car from what it is also tradition in an aesthetic approach, like on the numbers. For Chinese, it's extremely important to have the right combination of numbers in the number plate or in the place they live. There are several cultural elements that may give value to objects in their life. It's not too different from what we have in Europe and in the United States, if you want, but simply are different things. And the number plate in Asia, it's in important. General, it's important.
So you mentioned the Urus, which you introduced, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, something like that now?
In 2017, we announced it in December, and then the car arrived in the market in 2018.
So it quickly became your most popular car by far. what percentage of sales does it account for in China?
So in China, it's a little bit higher than on the rest of the world. At the moment, we are around about 55% of sales of Urus and 45% supersport cars. just
so over half.
Just to give you the sense of what is the highest production capacity for a Urus. If you look at the Hurricane, bestseller ever in our super sport car segment, just crossed the 20,000 units delivered since the launch in 2014. We were able with Urus to do the same number already starting from 2018.
Wow.
So it's going at twice as fast as Hurricane in terms of success. And because the growth is so relevant when it comes to Urus, obviously for Lamborghini, it means that mathematically the majority of the customers of Urus are new to the brand. And after 4 years, we have 80% of customers of Urus that are buying a Lamborghini for the first time in this 20,000 Urus that we have delivered. It's telling you a lot about the popularity of a brand that was there, but applied to a very small niche segment, that is the two doors, super sport cars, low cars with very small trunk and, you know, feel like a pilot idea cars. And then you apply this brand, these values, this DNA into a way bigger segment, even though you're still at the top of the iceberg. And so in a very niche part of it, the top in terms of pricing and so on and performance, but clearly is a way bigger market, and that opened up to a game change for us in terms of volumes and also in terms of profitability, because we found with Urus the element we were missing to stabilize the life cycles trend of our product, and make sure that we also gain a scale economy in many respects in our company that made possible to reach level of profitability that today are honestly second to none in the automotive industry. I don't recall anybody that is making more profit than us in percentage at the moment, considering the results of first semester that I've seen published. Lamborghini is for sure the most profitable in Volkswagen Group.
I think, obviously, I think Porsche, you know, a pioneer there, right, with the Cayenne, so they were the first. But I think in terms of Italian manufacturers, the Urus's huge success eventually forced even Ferrari, right? They just announced their first SUV crossover this year. So absolutely. I think your success forced Ferrari to even go down that road, which is, you know, in many people's minds would be the last company, because the DNA of all these Italian brands is so wrapped up in sports cars, but the economics are so much more in family cars. And I suppose, and you know this better than I do, but I suppose if you own, let's say, a Huracan or an Aventador, right, it just feels natural then to want an Urus in your garage so you can go pick up the kids and, you know, go take your family to dinner. I mean, you're not going to take that car, the Technica, with your mom to dinner, right? It's just not going to be the right car for that.
You're going to take your wife to dinner.
You can take your wife, but you won't take your mom.
What you're saying is very right.
Unless your mom is cool.
I think if you look at the average customer of a supersport car, they have 8 to 9 cars in their household.
Mm.
So obviously they have also the opportunity to have a car for every different occasion. They want a daily drive. Among these 8-9 cars, they don't want only collectible units or super sport cars that they mainly will use in weekends and when they're also ready for a more physical and deep experience. So the Urus has expressed, like many other cars that you mentioned, that kind of versatility that if you combine with the experience we have on high-end performance, high-end characteristics of the car when it comes to being a luxury product, then you have a really great opportunity to give the customer what they're looking for. Comfort when they need, practical solutions that allows you to go into the snow of Colorado.
Sure, all-wheel drive.
Yeah, all-wheel drive, adjustable suspensions, adjustable high ground clearance, and you know, a car that can go in a racetrack if you want it to. So Urus, in a sense, has really leveraged that kind of potential very, very well. But when it comes to Huracan, and I must say that this will remain the car that in the history of Lamborghini has really made the difference in between being a company that was doing very small volumes and almost, you know, being always in between break-evening and losing money, and made possible to get into that segment that is particularly competitive, where so many players are in, with a car that with 13 derivatives all over the life cycle has become a huge success. And we measure success in a way from the waiting list, from the waiting time. And this car at the end of its life cycle, because it's been launched already in 2014, so it's already 8 years, this version is essentially sold out. And so after we just launched it. So for us, this is telling us that we really have consolidated a presence in a segment where we know we have a leading presence, and we know that our consumer will be ready for what you already started to discuss, now that the new future version of this car in a hybrid solution, because this is part of the roadmap we have planned. So
yes, we'll talk about that in a second. I was at the Lamborghini factory back in 2014, I think. We were just switching from the Gallardo to this.
Exactly.
And by the way, you've got the best coffee. That coffee, the cafeteria there, is the coffee is incredible. So we were doing a factory tour, and I noticed there's this guy in the corner, and I recognized him, and it was Valentino Balboni, right? And I'm like, hey, Valentino, will you give me a ride? He goes, I'll give you a ride. So we get in the Valentino Balboni edition of the Gallardo.
The two-wheel drive.
Yeah, the two-wheel drive. And we are, unlike Ferrari, right, Lamborghini doesn't have its own test track. So we are flying around the city, and I look, and the speed limit is 60, and I look down, and he's doing 160.
We're living in a part of the country that is the countryside.
Uh-huh.
Bologna is just 20 kilometers away, but in the part of there are especially fields and few houses, and the reason why actually the company is there, the legend says, you know, that Ferruccio Lamborghini was based a few kilometers away, and he was looking for a spot to place the factory. And you know the story about his disappointment with a Ferrari, and so the reason why the company exists.
He went to Ferrari and he pointed out the problems with it, and then Ferrari said, go away.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
He did.
So he kind of had a little bit of, it was a little bit upset with Ferrari. But the story is that if you remember, when you arrive in Sant'Agata Bolognese, after you drive in these very empty roads in the countryside, there is a church in the middle of the road that forces you to just take a little turn, because otherwise the roads are very straight, and so you can go pretty fast if there is no traffic. And so what he thought, he said, oh, this is the place where the Ferrari tester are coming to, you know, put some speed on the car, because it's all straight. You have a great visibility, and you want to see if the car, you know, goes well at a high speed. And but here they will have to slow down because of the church in the middle of the road. They into S, and every time they will slow down, they will see my factory.
So that's why he put it there.
That's the legend.
That's the legend.
I don't know if it's true.
So Valentino Balboni was the test car driver since Lamborghini was there, the original, right? He'd been there for like 20 years or something.
He's been forever.
So we're flying, and I'm getting scared, because now we're, you know, passing cars like they're going backwards, not like they're standing still. And I go, Valentino, my foot is buried in the carpet, and, you know, I'm trying to brake for him, and I go, will you slow down? And he goes, no, you don't tell me when to slow down. And then he like slams on the brakes, and my eyeballs pop out, and I go, thank you very much. He goes, no, look there. And there was a speeding camera. So he knew where all the speeding cameras were at.
I bet he does. Everybody does.
Yeah. And then he's right back on it.
Well, it was, you know, 2014, traffic was probably a little less. Today, nowadays, I think traffic has increased a little bit, it wouldn't be safe, so we don't really encourage this this habit. But
and he's no longer with the company.
But he was a pro.
I think he left and started his own accessory business, if I remember right.
Yeah, I'm not sure about.
This was you were in China probably at the time.
Yeah.
All right, so let's go back to what's the future of Lamborghini, right? I mean, I thought that trucks would be the last vehicles to go electric. but now there's a whole bunch of new electric trucks. So it's really becoming, you know, supercars and hypercars, right? So how do you keep the passion? Because let's face it, the biggest distinguishing, there's two things that distinguish, I think, a car in people's minds, right? First is styling, and then there's the powertrain, right? The and then all that comes with it, all the emotion that comes with, like the heartbeat of the car, which is, you know, the engine. So how do you take something like a battery, which is very kind of left brain, right? It's very analytical, and put it into a car that's very right brain, which is very emotional. How do you walk that line? What, I'm sure you've done a lot of thinking about that.
Well, first of all, 2035 is not around the corner.
Yeah.
In automotive, it could be a relatively small time because it's 13 years and automotive is such a long history. But with the evolution of technology today, I would say that 13 years are a pretty long time to really imagine the future. And define it today is very difficult. So what we needed to do in Lamborghini was to make sure that we had a short midterm plan that was very clear and that was consistent with the regulations evolution that we can already see in the next few years. And so there was in our mind the clear roadmap that Mr. Winkelmann has essentially put together as soon as he came back into the role.
Mr. Winkelmann is the CEO of Lamborghini Alt.
He's the chairman of Automotive Lamborghini SPA.
And for those of you guys who aren't familiar, Lamborghini is part of the Volkswagen Group. So it shares components with, you know, or at least it shares chassis and certain technologies with some of the other cars in the group. So, like, we're talking about the Urus, which is basically, and I don't want to be, I shouldn't say basically, it's very similar to the Audi S7, right? There's
no.
Okay, so, all right, well, you tell me then. I'll let you.
No, I just invite you to drive them both and you'll see the difference.
There's some technology that is shared.
But this is automotive.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have to something to do with the group you belong to. Obviously, this is an possibility to share technologies and platform and share an investment. All the cars are four wheels and they share suppliers, even Lamborghini and Ferrari, just to name.
I said S7, I'm a Q7, sorry.
But the idea in the end is when you take those four wheels and you use eventually an engine that still have eight cylinder, like in the case of Urus, you start from an idea that could be common with other brands, but you develop it into something that is a package that delivers a complete different emotion and position the car in a complete different way. You mentioned RSQ8, or you mentioned Cayenne, you mentioned Urus. For sure, these are cars that have had in the beginning a cooperation, but they have ended up into three different complete products that have not just a different brand, but a complete different behavior and emotion delivered. So when it comes to electrification, just to come back to your question, for us, the roadmap is clear. We are going to hybridize all the cars in our range by the end of 2024. So in 2025, every Lamborghini will be hybrid. And we think that this was a great opportunity because we have seen the chance to combine an electric engine with an internal combustion engine that is clearly, without no doubt, still the demand of our consumer to have an internal combustion engine, but to add power without adding too much weight and doing it in the right way, the way we think is effective, without compromising in the driving dynamics, but improving them possibly, it's a great solution actually that will enable us to reach power before unreachable, still having an internal combustion engine. And the next V12, the Aventador successor, has been already announced to be a V12 hybrid. You can imagine that this is going to be a major step up in terms of power and performance. But also the Huracan successor and And the next derivatives of Hurus from 2020, end of 2024, will become hybrid. And we have decided that by the end of the decade, we will have at least one model fully electric. We don't know if it's going to be the fourth model, which we would like to add, because we think there is another segment we would like to explore with a brand like Lamborghini. We haven't finalized the decision in that regard, we will have, for sure, a fully electric vehicle. And we think that by 2028, or by the end of the decade at the latest, we will have defined what is our idea of driving dynamics for an electric car. Because today, to be completely honest, we don't think anybody has find the right solution. We see perfect longitudinal behavior in terms of acceleration. Electric cars are fantastic. But when it comes to the fun to drive, the braking, the curve, the behavior in acceleration out of a curve, or the behavior of the car at high speed, then this still requires a little bit of study, and we think that we will come whenever we will be ready, and only when we will be ready with a fully electric car, to make sure that we deliver the same level of emotion that our DNA and heritage suggests.
Yeah, you know, I woke up the other night, like in bed, and I kind of had this epiphany. And the epiphany was, it's kind of sad, because I was like, you know what? All electric cars basically drive the same. And what I mean by that is, okay, so you've got instant torque, right? And once you experience that once, be it in a model as Plaid or be it in any of the other vehicles, it's the same thing, right? It's always just snaps your neck back. And with an internal combustion engine car, you've got the power that comes on in different ways, right? Whether it's normally aspirated or it's supercharged or it's turbocharged, there are different power curves. With electric motors, it's always the same. You get full torque right away. And the other thing that you realize about electric cars is that they're all very heavy, which in some ways is good. When you're going down an American highway, it gives you a much better ride because you've got a very settled in feeling on the car. But then, of course, that weight is not so good when you're going around a corner, because it starts to push the car and you start to feel the weight. And I think engineers are going to have to work hard to distinguish electric cars from each other, because, like I say, to me, they all kind of, there's a couple, we bought a long-term Hummer EV recently, and that is so crazy that it drives differently, right? Well, you take a 9,500-pound truck and you accelerate it from 0 to 60 in about 3.5 seconds. It's just something that's very weird and strange. So that drives differently. But as you know, most of the current electric cars that the people are buying are mid-size crossovers, right? That you know, from the ID4 to the Mach-E to the Tesla Model Y, they're all mid-size crossovers. And to me, they're just kind of the same flavor of ice cream. You know, what I'm hoping for is one of my favorite things in Italy when I'm there is gelato. You've got, you know, in America, the problem, sorry guys, if you like American gelato, but America, you have some gelato and let's say it's strawberry, right? You put it in your mouth and you taste sweet and then you taste the strawberry. So you taste the sugar and then you taste the strawberry. But in Italy, you get some strawberry gelato and you taste the strawberry and then maybe it's sweet. Or if it's, you know, if it's stracciata, then you taste, you know what I mean? You taste the flavors first. And I'm hoping that somebody like Lamborghini will figure out how to make an electric car that is a Lamborghini versus just, you know, instant torque and, like you said, straight line speed.
No, I promise you it will be like that. Otherwise, we will not do it. Yeah. We don't think that there's only electrification. In long term, we need to explore also other possibilities to go, in any case, carbon neutral. This is also another promise that we are doing since a few years. We already have our factory carbon neutral since 2015, so it's been a commitment since many years. And gradually, we will come to that also for our cars. In any case, we think that there is a possibility for electric cars, we're not going to be the pioneers on that. We're just going to arrive to the market when we are ready.
Now, you said hybrid. Are we talking plug-in hybrids, or are we talking traditional hybrids?
Well, plug-in hybrid, that's what it's going to be, but I cannot say much more.
Okay,
than
fair
that.
Enough. So there will be some all-electric range that you can have in it versus, you know, floor it and motor kicks on. All right, so let's talk about while you're here. So you're here in Colorado because you were here at the Lamborghini dealership, which is south of Denver, and you guys have restyled it. I believe there are, 48 dealerships, is that right, in the U.S.?
In America.
In America.
We have 48 dealers. In the United States, we have 39,
mm-hmm.
and this new dealership was we signed the deal in 2020 during the pandemic, so there was not an opportunity to really complete immediately the preparation of the showroom and celebrate it. So we wanted to find a moment to gather with our customers here, but also with Mike Ward, that is our investor in Denver, and celebrate that partnership. Must say that Mike is doing a pretty good job, and we are very happy with the showroom. And so I invite you to visit if you have the chance. There's not going to be new cars there, most likely only pre-owned, because everything is pre-sold. And unless a customer is picking up the car, you're not going to be able to see the most recent product range. There may be some nice pre-owned.
So let's say I want a Technica. How long would it take me to get one? How long of a waitlist?
Sold out.
Sold out. You can't get one.
No, everybody's already submitted a booking. And so
that's incredible. Mm-hmm. Wow. That must be a good place to be in terms of, like, you know, in terms of factory planning, in terms of product planning, to know exactly every one of their models is already gone.
You see, the main important thing is that this gives a company confidence and the profitability that enable us to make bold investment into the future. And so only to electrify our product range with the strategy I described before, we have put aside $1.8 billion. It wouldn't be so easy to convince your investor of this scale of investment if you wouldn't have this clear trust from the consumers and the customers that, you know, are already submitting since a few years a request for the next V12, for example. So you need a kind of solidity, a profit to the level of the top brands in luxury, and I'm not talking about automotive, I'm talking about luxury, whether it is in fashion or in jewelry or watchmaking industry. You need a kind of profitability to then invest this kind of resources that is typical of our industry, that is capital intensive and requires this kind of effort. But, you know, every time you push the button in a direction, you cannot change that much because it's such a capital intensive, and clearly you need to, you know, that you place your fish into a precise direction, and you're not going to be so flexible in changing. So it's always a big challenge being a player in automotive. But nowadays, thanks to these results, like in Technica or Urus Performante, Urus S, also the demand
also
is
sold
incredible.
Out right away. Yeah. Yeah.
It gives you the
mind. Is that a reflection of the economy? What will happen if 6 months from now, you know, we're looking at a whole different, or a year from now, we're looking at a whole different economy? Will the demand for, you know, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 Lamborghinis dry up? Is that something you worry about?
Not really. I think the demand for sure has been particularly strong post-pandemic, but Lamborghini was already in that position. We had already a long waiting time for Urus even before pandemic. And if you look at the situation today in our specific segment, the super sport car or the super SUVs, you will see winner and losers. And so we're very proud to say that we are among the few winners, and those that have gained a trust that is not just going to disappear. The residual value of our cars are telling you already a story. Obviously, they can fluctuate, like in the stocks exchange, based on demand and offer. But we think that Lamborghini has designed a strategy where we always will be several thousands of cars below demand. And so why, you may ask? Because we are not focused on volumes. We want to grow, but marginally. We want to grow in profitability. And we want to grow in our ability to commit to future projects, because this is what a luxury company does.
Yeah, that's an interesting question I've always wondered. So let me just take Porsche for example, right? So right now, if you wanted to buy a Porsche GT3, actually, I'll tell you a real story. So I had a friend who had a reservation on the GT3, and he gets a call from the salesman. And the salesman says, I've got some bad news for you. If you want that GT3, it's going to cost you $25,000 more for the allocation. And he's like, this is outrageous. You know, I put my money down for, you know, whatever they cost, $170,000 or $180,000. And I speak with the manager, and the manager gets on the phone, and the manager says, oh, I'm sorry about that. It's $50,000 more. Take it or leave it. Right, which to me suggests two things. One, that's pretty ballsy, but the other thing that it suggests is that the Porsche is underpricing that car, right? So if the market says it's worth 200 or 250,000 and they're selling it at 150,000, that could be money that could be going back into Porsche, or in your case back into Lamborghini, which then you could use to develop, you know, next generations of cars, as opposed to going to the dealer who's going to buy a boat with it or whatever they do with it. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I think the story you're describing is a sort of exception, because all the mature dealers you talk to understand very clearly an important rule, okay, of this business. What you got to do is, using the MSRP, again, nobody forces you, because the law and the manufacturer cannot enforce it. But it's going to be the market who will enforce it. Because if I am a customer and I hear from a dealer that the car I got an allocation for is costing me more than what the MSRP will be, I first will just go to another dealer in the United States, because I can buy it from another dealer just in another state. Also, what the dealer understand, at least ours, but in general players in the luxury business, is that the real business is in the pre-owned. So what you get to do is work with a fair approach, with the good customers that will return the car to you in case they want to sell it. Mm. They will help you to protect the residual value of your cars, and they will always refer to the dealer and to the manufacturer to create a bond and a relationship that is stable, because that is the only way to get a location for future cars that will be scarce. Like we said, there will be always more demand than supply as far as we are concerned. So we will make sure that this happens. So we will always look into the scarcity of our brand new cars. And for the dealer, should be sufficient to make full profit. In the past, the supersport car business has been a business where you could get discounts. It's unthinkable. And the car should go to that customer that is ready to customize the car more than another, rather than going to anybody, and rather than to go to somebody that is willing to resell it. So I think it's a rational approach to sell at MSRP, and then leverage the opportunity on the second-hand markets, because that is where today pre-owned cars, it's priced to a higher price of a brand new car, but you have to wait 1 year and a half, 2 years to get a new car. The pre-owned, you get it now, so obviously you pay a premium on it. It's all fair. And if you make it transparent and clear, everybody's maximizing its profitability. The customers in the first place, because they make a good investment. Because the worst case scenario of a customer buying a Lamborghini today, if he changes his mind, is that returning, they gets exactly the same money. Should it sell it and make, you know, a speculation on the car? I don't think so, because he will lose his privileges for future cars allocation. So, and this is a system that stands alone and adds value to the dealer, to the customers, to the manufacturer. Everybody's happy.
The one thing that has changed, though, is in the past, when you bought a car, let's say a Lamborghini Diablo or a Countach, right? The price of the car was X, and then over time it would go down, 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 and then it would slowly hit the bottom, and then over maybe a 20 or 30 year period, it would start to come back up, and at some point that Countach or Diablo would be worth more than the original MSRP. But since COVID, what's happened with a lot of these cars is the price never goes down. It just goes straight up, right? So you buy the Lamborghini at X, and then a year later, it's X plus 10% or X plus 20%. Not all cars, but it's happening to a lot of cars, especially the very sought-after limited edition cars.
like I said, the demand may change throughout the years, but what we have today, it's a product range that is extremely appealing, that has reached a level of quality, performance, and positioning in the market that is pretty unique. Maybe at the time of Diablo, we were having a car that has a way smaller niche in the first place. Demand was different from this kind of cars. But also, there was a different ability in the company to realize a product that was as qualitative, perfect as these cars nowadays are. So, obviously, the market has expanded, completely transformed to the market we had in the 90s. And for Lamborghini, just to make it clear, the first 40 years, we delivered few hundreds cars per year. So to see the thousands, you need to wait to be in the first 10 years of the century. And to be really significantly above the 2000, you need to be in the second decade. So Lamborghini has gone through a profound transformation. Has always been a company that created iconic cars, but has only in the last 22 years that has managed to get into a business that is also profitable and to a scale that is the current.
How many cars do you sell annually? Is it like 5?
We delivered 8,400 cars last year in worldwide.
That's a lot.
Yeah, 2,900 in America.
I've been to the factory. It's small.
Yeah, yeah. It's small, but it's 8,000 cars in a market of 80 million cars. Yeah. You can understand that it's not much.
How many of those cars are bespoke? I mean, how many of your customers actually go and then configure the car versus the dealer configuring the car? What's kind of the mix of that?
Well, especially for Super Sport Car, where the offer is wider, there's no car that it's configured nowadays without some ad personam content or some specific accessories. Everybody's trying to the extent of their creativity and patience, because also can take a little longer to get a car fully customized than with a special livery or some rare carbon fiber. So, depending on the combination of the request of the customers, I'd say that everybody tries to configure a car, and it's become a big part of our business, has become a big part of our focus, and a big part of our profitability.
Hmm. So obviously you make more money with accessories and with, you know, a lot of additional features, and that also gives them, the buyer, the ability to build their personal Lamborghini versus the one that, you know, is at the dealership.
It's something we encourage, of course. A turnover is higher for us, is higher for the dealer. The value for the car is higher because it's more unique for the customer. Is also
do people build ugly cars?
Well, that's very personal opinion, and but I
do you ever go down the line? I'm like, what the heck is that?
It's very rare because especially the most extreme ad personam, that is our program of customization, cars are with the support of a consultant. So we try to make sure that the customers also have a car that he will like after 6 months, that he is not going to be thinking, you know, I should have done a combination of color that I like it also after a year or after 2 years, or it's...
So you want the customer to be happy?
We want the customer to be happy, but we want also the customer to understand that the more unique is its car, the biggest is the value, and also for us, it's just making sure that every car is possibly is different from the other, and it's... Again, it's adding value to the chain. Everybody's happy in the end.
So I promised an hour, and we're almost at an hour, so I'll ask you two more questions, and then I'll let you go. As you know, you had some Aventadors on a ship that sank, right?
Yes.
And then you had to go and rebuild them. Was that difficult to have to restart the line and actually...
It was.
Yeah?
But it was not about restarting the line, because when we lost the 15 Aventador Ultime, which were already... promised to customers and important customers, because the car is extremely rare and iconic, the last naturally aspirated V12. And so when we lost the cars, and when we saw the boat sinking, because in the beginning that the concern was, are we gonna recover the boat?
Sure.
Will be the cars ruin or just partially? Should we repair
it?
You don't know.
So
we didn't know. When the boat sank, and we were sure we lost it, and so we really look each other into the eyes and said, how are we going to build it? Because we already have stretched the supply chain.
There was a little COVID, yeah,
cars.
It was hard.
We have already struggled with some suppliers, and so it was 15 cars, so we worked together with our supplier, with our parts warehouse, and we will look into what we could do, and we made sure that we come out with a solution with the customers, because we couldn't really let them down. But yes, it was a challenge above the delay, and that was also necessary to impose to the consumer. We had Urus, we had Hurricane on the same boat, but in that case it was just a delay, and we knew that we can rebuild it. But Aventador Ultima was a challenge, but we made it.
So you promised something and you delivered it.
Yes, we worked nice. It out because we
right.
had to.
And this is in American English, my softball question. Softball means in my easy question. Yeah. So you build three cars. What's your favorite?
You build?
Oh. Yeah, Lamborghini builds three cars,
okay.
Three models. What's your
in
favorite?
In the history, okay.
Now. What's your favorite?
Oh, right now.
Yeah.
Okay, STO,
yeah.
Technica,
Urus Performante. Yeah. What's your favorite and why?
What I will buy...
And tell me historically what's your favorite.
STO. I will take an STO.
I got to drive that.
Yeah.
I got to drive that at Willow Springs.
Yeah, I was there, yeah.
Yeah, I was scary. I was scared. I was driving, and the driver in front of me said, okay, now we put in Corsa mode. And I'm like, what does Corsa mode do? And he's like, well, that turns a lot of the nannies off, you know? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. And that's why, so Paul, who went and drove the Technica, used to be the Stig on Top Gear USA. So when you had this program, I'm like, you know, I don't drive the race cars. We'll let Paul go do that. He can, he's much better at it, and he can talk about it more than I can because he's a race car driver. I'm just a journalist.
Willow Spring is a particularly challenging racetrack.
It is.
You know,
it is.
The surface of the racetrack.
It's got a lot of elevation change.
The elevation change, the whole surface. But I really was blown away when I drove the STO. That was also my first time
I drove
the STO. And the braking... of that
That's
car,
the
control and the cure, everything was so intuitive and easy, even in Corsa mode, that I, for me is and will remain the best expression of Hurricane, even though for a general purpose.
It's a race car for the road.
It is a race car.
Yeah, it's a race car.
So you need to be maybe more oriented to track. Mm-hmm. If you are more oriented to road, Technica is the best expression of Hurricane ever. So we really needed to create that kind of dualism to make sure that we support both kind of customers. But to me, that I've never been necessarily a track-oriented driver. I'm not a pro driver or so skilled, but I have had in these 12 years so many opportunities to go to the racetrack that once I got into the STO, I was smiling all the time. So I really loved it.
Yeah, that it is. It is pure passion at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
You can feel. You can
goosebumps.
Feel,
and, yeah.
All right. So historically, what's your favorite Lamborghini? That's the last question.
It's the STO.
It's even historically, really, not a Countach or a.
No. I drove a Miura. I also have the opportunity. And I have to thank Jay Leno because he gave me his car and we went around. So I drove a 350 GT. I drove also some classic cars. And I think I really love to own an STO.
I have a friend here in Colorado who he's a big car collector. He's got like I think 450 cars, and he collects three brands. He collects Lamborghini, he collects Lotus and Buick. Don't ask me why Buick, but it's strange, right? And he's got apparently there were seven models of Countach, seven, and he's got all seven of them. And he's got the Super Leggero, which is he was showing it to me, and he goes, don't ever even push it because it's so thin that if you push on it, you'll actually push the metal in. And he also has, if you remember, we used to call it the Lambo Rambo which was the
SUV. 002.
Yeah, exactly. With the
Yes,
he's got one of those with the 12-cylinder from the Countach.
It's the first Urus.
Yes, and that one is just that one is a crazy Lamborghini.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
The proportion of R-cars has always been a little bit out of the ordinary, and I think the LM002 at that time was really something unique.
Yeah.
I'm glad that in the end we managed to build something that is on that kind of positioning, and Urus, you know, I'm so happy we have it.
Yeah. So there's heritage for the Urus.
Yes, there was. It's when we had to decide what was going to be the third model. I can tell you there was for sure a debate whether it should have been a sedan, a four-door sedan, or an SUV. And we were back in 2012 when the Beijing Auto Show was the place where we displayed for the first time a maquette of the Urus. The reaction was unmistakably positive
right.
for an SUV, and so luckily we took that decision. I think it was really the right one.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to come to our studios. I really appreciate getting to know you and getting to know more about the brand. I'll leave your comments and your questions as always. And remember, if you want more TFL content, go to alltfl.com. See you guys next time. Ciao.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.